Okay. Hi, good morning, everyone. I think that we, or afternoon, sorry, afternoon. So I think that we have the majority of everyone signed in. So thank you again for calling, and I will pass the baton on to Dean Tomaselli.
And we have Dr. Goldstein on as well.
Hi, everybody.
Yeah, hi, Harris. So thank you, everybody, for joining. This is a remarkable and unprecedented time right now. Obviously, there have been a lot of things going on at Einstein, but let me just introduce myself. I'm Gordon Tomaselli. I'm the dean at Einstein, and I have on the phone with me an internationally renowned expert in infectious disease and immunology, Dr. Harris Goldstein, who's going to be speaking to you in just a few minutes about COVID-19, this novel coronavirus pandemic that's ongoing now. I know that you've heard a lot from Dr. Fauci on the TV. Harris worked with Dr. Fauci for a number of years in the 1980s and is really a leading expert in this area and can bring us up to date. This is a kind of a sobering time in the sense that it is a pandemic that's hit the United States and hit New York in a very definitive and serious way. There are over 250,000 cases of infection worldwide. And in the United States, over about 15,000, of which about nearly 10,000 are those people who are infected in the state of New York. So we've actually had to change a lot of our operations on campus. Some medical students are learning remotely. We've ratcheted down a lot of research in the laboratories, except that is related to COVID-19 research. And we've changed our operations, at least in the short term, so that we can be good stewards of the public health and make sure that we're doing everything we can to prevent a large increase in number of cases that would overwhelm our health system. So that's kind of where things stand at the medical school. And what I'd like to do now is to just introduce Dr. Harris Goldstein, who's our Senior Associate Dean for Scientific Resources at Einstein. He's also the director of the Einstein Rockefeller CUNY Center for AIDS Research. He's the Charles Michael Chair in Autoimmune Diseases and a professor of both pediatrics, microbiology, and immunology. And he's going to share some of the work that's ongoing here and elsewhere on COVID-19. To bring you up to date on what we're doing here at Einstein and what's going on kind of nationwide. So, Harris, thanks for joining us, and it's the phone's yours.
Right, so I think that most people know a lot about it already, so I'm not going to reiterate what people know, but I think what I would like to do is put it in kind of more of a global context and also underline how research that's being done every day really is rapidly being applied to something such as this pandemic. And again, how supporters of Einstein who have supported that research really are having an impact in that way. And what I'd really like to start out by just talking about the fact that as we all know, or many of us know, that genetic information can be passed on through DNA. So the way that we pass our genetic information on is by having DNA in our cells that make RNA, which is a molecules that now encode proteins that are ultimately the building blocks of organisms ranging from single cell organisms all the way up to us. That's the normal building, that's normal kind of, if you think about blueprint, that's the normal blueprint for our organisms and living beings. However, there's an alternative way of encoding genetic information that many of you are familiar with, and that is using RNA, because DNA makes RNA, and then RNA makes proteins. So some of organisms, particularly viruses, have basically decided to eliminate the DNA and basically say, let's just put all our genetic information in RNA, and then let's use that as the way of encoding the proteins we need to function. And it turns out that there are many viruses that instead of using DNA, use RNA. And the one that we are most familiar with is HIV. HIV is uses two strands of RNA that now can make its proteins. However, a problem that HIV faces is kind of like a situation where you're in a foreign country and you don't speak the language. So you could talk all you want in English and you could raise the volume of your voice, but it's not going to help because they're not going to understand you. So if HIV gets inside of a cell and the cell needs DNA as the way of starting the process of making proteins, then it just won't make it. So HIV has to have some way of translating that RNA into DNA and then enabling it now to make the RNA to make the viral proteins. The same way that many of you, I'm sure, whip out your cell phones, use Google Translate to translate your English into the other language you want, and then immediately pass it over to other individuals. However, a problem that many of you may have faced when using Google Translate is that when you actually have the second language that it's translated into, it's not exactly the right syntax, it's not exactly the right perfect way of speaking it, and the people you tell to usually kind of like chuckle a little bit and smile because they realize that you're really not speaking it very well, but you get your message across. The same thing occurs with these viruses when they infect the cells, but in so doing, these kind of changes or mutations actually can change the proteins and actually change the viral structure. And that is why these viruses that use RNAs are particularly mutate a lot, and that's exactly what seems to happen in terms of how a virus that normally infects an animal can now jump across the barrier and now start infecting humans because it's made this leap of changing its RNA structure, either through a translation mutation or potentially what we call like a cross-linking, or some of the RNA kind of duplicated itself or crossed over onto itself. And that seems to be how COVID basically went from animal into human. Now, another important aspect of it is the route of infection is really crucial in terms of how infectious agents will be in terms of generating epidemic or pandemic. So all of you are familiar with the fact that HIV is transmitted predominantly either sexually or blood through blood transfusion. It is not transferred through aerosol, and therefore HIV is relatively easy to control in terms of transmission. However, COVID, as you all know now, is transmitted through aerosol, and how long it hangs around and how far it's transmitted, again, those are all in process of being developed. That's why we have the 6-foot distance for social distancing, because we assume that's how far the aerosol can spread. But again, that's why it's resulting in epidemic that it is right now. Now, the other aspect of being an RNA virus is that some of the drugs that have worked for HIV that target the enzymes that are required for translating the genetic information from RNA or into DNA, or that are other proteins that HIV utilizes to kind of structure as proteins, potentially can be effective against COVID and 19. And that's why many of you have been reading about a drug called remdesivir, which was made by a company for HIV use, is now being repurposed to see if it works against COVID because it's targeting this translation from RNA into DNA, and there's some preliminary results that are highly suggestive that it's beneficial. And in fact, to highlight some of the work that's being done here at Einstein, we are actually have clinical trials in progress with our patients in Montefiore infected that are being placed on remdesivir to see if it works. It's a 19-site trial, and we're part of it, and hopefully it'll have effectiveness. There are other drugs that people have been hearing about, chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, that have been touted as possibly useful. And again, it's early to tell, but clinical trials will be needed to determine if they are effective. Another point that I want to highlight is advances that have been made in HIV have really played a critical role in accelerating our ability to respond to COVID. Because if we turn the clock back 30 years from when HIV first emerged, it took over 3 years before we even knew it was a virus causing HIV and before we even knew that it was an infectious agent and what the virus was and the ability to generate a way of detecting whether someone has been infected with HIV. I know people on the call remember that time frame, but there was a time when someone we thought had HIV, we did not have a way of doing the testing. So it wasn't a question of not having enough tests available. There was no test, and it took years to develop that test. In contrast, within weeks of this virus first being appreciated in China, the scientists in China had sequenced the entire gene of this virus. Again, these are all capabilities that have been generated through our work with HIV, and rapidly developed a test to detect this RNA virus, which is exactly just modifying the test that we routinely use to measure the RNA HIV virus that's present in patients' blood. So again, that's been incredible demonstrating how advances in one area of research, HIV, can rapidly be translated to really be mobilized for COVID-19. And in terms of another approach that is being utilized that you may not have heard about is using antibodies to as a treatment. So people may be aware that if someone steps on a rusty nail and they haven't had a tetanus vaccine in 15 years, giving them a vaccine won't help them because it takes at least a month before the immune system can respond to a vaccine, and by then it might be too late. So what we give patients is we give them immunoglobulin, and that immunoglobulin is targeted against the tetanus toxin to protect them from the sequela of a tetanus infection. And that works right away. So we would love to be able to give patients that are infected with COVID antibodies that would enable them now to fight the COVID infection. However, we don't have those antibodies available. And again, work actually done at Rockefeller by Michelle Nussenzweig developed an amazing technology that enables them to isolate the actual B cells, which are the factories that make the specific antibodies for specific viruses or pathogens, from infected individuals, get the blueprint for that antibody, put it into cells that can crank out grams and grams of that antibody at a quality that can now be used to treat patients. This has been used to treat HIV, this has been used to treat Zika, and this has been used to treat Ebola. And now we have a group at Einstein that is doing that. They are taking blood from patients infected with COVID, they're isolating the B cells, and then they're getting the genetic information from the B cells to make antibodies. And if things work well, these should potentially be available for therapeutic use in probably aggressively maybe 6 months, which means if COVID comes back in September, we could potentially have ways of dealing with that. And my laboratory is looking at ways of mobilizing other limbs of the immune system, T cells and K cells, to rapidly mobilize them to fight the infection. So I'll end here, just and hopefully that's been helpful in giving a perspective about COVID, what makes it different, and how we're applying technologies from other viral infections to help us develop both ways of diagnosing as well as treating COVID.
So, Harris, thanks. And just to summarize, lots of basic research going on, but also on the health system side, we have an ongoing clinical trial of remdesivir for treatment of COVID, as well as the use of some of these antiparasitic drugs like chloroquine to treat this infection. And we're also scaling up to increase the capacity to do testing. So what I thought we'd do right now is just open up the floor for questions for Dr. Goldstein or myself, or any questions that you might have about this pandemic, and probably do this for the next 10 or 15 minutes as time permits.
So, Dean Tomaselli, we have some questions that some people submitted ahead of time.
Okay.
So I could start with those, and then people could follow up. So the first question I have is, what is the condition of a recovered patient's respiratory system? That's an excellent question. And like a lot of these questions, the answer is going to be, we don't know. But I would propose, and there's been, at least in China, some reports that there may be some permanent sequela, but I would propose is that it probably depends on how severe the respiratory damage is to the lung. If it's mild, patient didn't require a respirator, patient just had some coughing, some shortness of breath, but never required significant support, I would propose that it's probably minimal to non-detectable damage. Unfortunately, if it is more severe than the patient, just as someone has a bad case of tuberculosis, may have some permanent damage.
And a bit of good news here is we think that most people who get infected and have relatively mild symptoms. So we expect and hope that there won't be many people who are left with really serious residual lung disease who survive the infection.
Right, and that's an excellent point because, again, all of you reading the papers and know that for the overwhelming majority of people infected with COVID-19, pretty mild. It's only for people, well, not only, but we, again, just a caveat, we are definitely seeing cases of individuals in their 30s and 40s and even younger that will have severe sequelae. Very, very unusual, but it does happen. Again, another reason to stress that people who shouldn't think just because they're young, they don't have to worry about being infected, something that Dr. Fauci and others have been stressing over and over again. Second question, when do we expect the virus to peak in New York City? Is Montefiore and Einstein ready for it? We're pretty much can't answer that question. People are talking in terms of May for a time for peaking. But again, as Dr. Fauci and others have pointed out, by engaging in social distancing, we feel, and other interventions, we feel that that will, quote, flatten the curve. Because if you're not in contact with someone that's infected, you absolutely cannot get infected. So if somebody would lock themselves in their apartment with provisions to last a month, they won't get infected. So therefore, by everybody sequestering themselves, we'll limit the ability of the virus to spread. Hopefully, that will both reduce the peak and may potentially delay the peak, but it'll do it at a way that the peak is far, far, far lower than it is now. And in addition, it'll allow the healthcare system to be able to handle the far fewer individuals that are infected with COVID-19, which is a reason why that's being stressed over and over again. We want to minimize the number of cases so we don't overwhelm the healthcare system. And that's on point to the second question, is Montefiore and Einstein ready for it? And the answer I would say is as ready as anybody can be, given the global impact of that, which is so overwhelming that I doubt that anyone can say they were completely ready for it, but we're ready for it in terms of being able to call upon resources that we can. So for example, Einstein investigators who have masks, gloves, and other personal protection equipment are donating it to Montefiore. You've been reading again that there is a shortage of those materials, and that is something that hopefully will be addressed in the very near future. And again, if anyone has any questions or comments, just jump in.
Good. So, Harris, here's as a pediatrician, you can address this one. Initial reports said that children didn't get COVID-19. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so this is a classic example of never being absolute and saying never and impossible, things like that. Clearly, children can get infected. They tend to have a far, far more benign course. And the latest data from today is that at the Children's Hospital at Montefiore, we've tested 22 children. Only one of them have been positive. 8 tests are negative and 13 are pending. And my understanding is that one individual that was positive so far is asymptomatic. So having
that's different than the adult experience in the Montefiore system, where I think on upwards of 300 people now have been considered to be at risk, and the positive rate in that group